Welcome to From the Studio, our occasional presentation of the thoughts of area musicians and artists on their work. And we have a pair of such worthies in our studio this morning. A very frequent guest here at SPR Classical, James Lowe, the music director of the Spokane Symphony. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Jim.
Welcome back. And someone who has made appearances here in the past few years, principal trombonist of the symphony, John Church. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
It's good to have you both here, and we are here because there's a program. We have packed up all the Nutcracker costumes and sets.
Mice have been defeated.
And the holiday arrangements have all been refiled. And now it's time to get back to work on the rest of the 80th anniversary season of the orchestra. And the fourth Masterworks program comes up this this weekend. And it's Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 3 in the afternoon at the Fox Theater. It's called Symphonic Dances, and James, maybe clue us in a little bit on the overall picture of this or the reason for being of this particular program in the season.
Well, every time I start a program, I try and start with a kernel of one idea and then see where it takes me. And this kernel actually started with John Church here. When I asked him if he would like to play a trombone concerto, which we'll come to in a minute, he chose the Paul Creston. And when I listened to the work, it's a very rhythmic work and very punchy work, and I thought, oh well, that would pair perfectly with Bernstein. I thought, with great, you know, almost contemporaries as composers too. So there's Symphonic Dances and West Side Story, and then I thought, well, there's Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances too, which is a very, very different kind of music from Bernstein. But I thought, how interesting would it be to put these two together, particularly because weirdly they both use saxophone, and the way Rachmaninoff uses the saxophone is a different planet from the way Bernstein uses it. So I thought this would be an interesting combination of program. The only problem with it is it's incredibly difficult for the orchestra. It's probably the most difficult program we've tackled this season. But the orchestra are sounding phenomenal, because I think the music for them is, it's just such enjoyable music to play.
And you say that it is a difficult program to play, and just to kind of parse that a little bit more, because, for example, with Leonard Bernstein, he just went places where mere mortals fear to tread in terms of the way he writes his music.
That's right. I mean, and I think obviously it's in a kind of jazz idiom, but it's got music, it's got other kinds of music. There's mambo in there, there's cha-cha in there, and then there's kind of straight jazz. But I think the way Bernstein straddled those two worlds himself as a musician and performer and composer, he really understands how orchestras work. Obviously, he was one of the very greatest conductors who ever lived. So he knew how to write music. Now, of course, it was actually orchestrated by Owen Costell and Sid Rahman. Sid was his schoolmate. In fact, they grew up together, which is kind of cute. But the way he managed to, the way Bernstein notates these rhythms for classical players, it really comes out sounding perfectly like you know how to play jazz.
Right, right. And what we're talking about, for those who may have struggled to keep it together and they're playing 4-4 and 3-4 time pieces, just for fun, what are some of the more unusual time signatures?
Well, actually, this is the interesting thing about this piece, is there's very little in the way of weird time changes. It's not like Stravinsky Ride Spring or anything like that. It's just the way he notates. And the way jazz notation tends to work, of course, is you're notating across the beats. So very rarely do things kind of fall onto the straight beats. And there's also a feel you have to have. You know, there are things that really are not notatable, that you just have to know. So you know that this particular bit before the cool fugue, for example, is swung, which is, say, you kind of tripletize these rhythms. And that's just stuff you have to know. But the way he writes it out, it's so clear how he wants it to be performed. It really is, it's a genius work, I think, generally speaking. I think West Side Story is probably the greatest musical ever written.
We get used to hearing things like, I mean, take Bizet in the opera Carmen, suites extracted from that, which are just this lovely series of pieces that have a kind of unity and completeness in themselves without any real contact intimate contact with the original source material. But isn't it true that the symphonic dances from West Side Story, it's not just a set of dances, it's a kind of musical retelling of the story?
Yeah, it does. It follows very kind of broadly the story. Of course, it's, everybody knows, it's based on Romeo and Juliet. And it starts with one of the street gangs being louche and generally troublemakers. And then it goes through with Tony and Maria's Beautiful Somewhere. And then there's the rumble. And then, of course, at the end, it ends with the tragedy at the end. And the genius of Bernstein is that he buries this interval, the tritone, augmented fourth, in the whole thing. And it's hidden everywhere. And at the very, very end of the piece, you have the little fragment of Somewhere with Hope. And then in comes this dissonant tritone underneath it, just to say, not for you guys. Mm-hmm. It's such a clever device, but it doesn't sound academic at all. It's just the genius of Bernstein.
And again, it's wonderful to start a program with tunes that are immediately recognizable. It kind of pulls you right into the performance. So I'm talking with James Lowe and John Church about the fourth of the Masterworks programs of the current Spokane Symphony season, taking place this weekend at the Fox Theater. And don't forget that James will share with you lots of fun info about the whole program. You'll be pulling John on stage for the lecture beforehand.
Quite possibly. He doesn't know it yet.
What? Well, you heard it here first. So it's always a joy to hear a little bit about the performance, and that comes along at 6:30 on Saturday night and at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. All right. Well, we get all warmed up and cosified, if that's a word, by the Bernstein, this wonderfully familiar music. And then we make the leap to the music of Paul Creston, which I find to be just remarkable stuff. And remarkable stuff from a self-taught, pretty much, American composer, whose name was not Creston when he was born.
No, I think it was something like Gutaveggio.
Gutaveggio, the one, Giuseppe Gutaveggio.
Which seems quite far from Paul Creston. Not quite sure how he, anglified the Gutaveggio to Creston, but...
Well, that was the thing back in this particular day, because he was born in 1906, and the kind of assimilation writ large was something that was very much a part of the... a sociological picture at that point. But bless his heart, he changed his name and he wrote lots of music and just really, I find, compelling music that really goes across many, many genres. And it includes this fantasy for trombone and orchestra that we'll be hearing with our soloist, John Church. And John, just to kind of set a context here, you and the trombone, where did it all get started?
So it got started in sixth grade. I was around 11 or 12 years old, so I've been playing for about 22 years or so. But it wasn't the first instrument I really picked up in my life. I mean, in elementary school, they always got you to pick up the recorder, the guitar. And I remember I really wanted to play the guitar. And then in sixth grade, my parents and I, we went to the orientation, and they said you could do PE or band. And my parents, they told me I've been doing sports, ever since I could remember. It's like, why not try band? I can play the cymbals or the triangle or something, right?
What's to lose?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, might as well try something new. And I said, okay. And so you go to the first day of class, and the band director, Randy McRae, he was my band director, and he asked everyone what they wanted to play. I wanted to play trumpet. I wanted to play the trumpet, and so did everyone else, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
And he had enough of the trumpets, and so basically he needed more trombones. And I didn't know what that was, so I took home this case, that had that musty smell. You all know what I'm talking about, that really nice old case smell. And then I played it for a couple weeks, didn't really understand it, really. I was making some sounds, of course, but then he handed me a CD Randy McRae did, of Joseph Alessi, who's the principal trombone of the New York Philharmonic since the mid-80s, a trombone giant in the world of trombone. And it was his New York Legends album. And the very first track was Leonard Bernstein, Elegy for Mippy 2, which is an unaccompanied kind of esque a little solo. You actually accompany yourself with your foot tapping. Mm. It was written for his brother's dog. It's a rather sad piece, but it's actually fun, you know, and it's a really interesting little number. So I remember when I heard that, I got really inspired, and that was it. Mm-hmm. From there on, I wanted to play trombone, and, you know, obviously sports was still in my life all the way through the end of high school, but I kind of knew that trombone wanted to be the main center of my life, I guess.
So. And where did you go to school from that point on?
So for college. Mm-hmm. So for undergraduate degree, I went to the University of Oregon and got my music performance with Henry Henniger. I should also state, though, in high school and middle school, I studied with a gentleman named Mike Oft, and he really set me on a really good path for lessons from seventh grade all the way through the end of high school. And my band director in high school was Kevin Sipple, and just want to say all these people that have inspired me and got me where I am. Okay, so then undergrad, yeah, with Henry and Henniger, and then I went to Rice University to get my master's at the Shepherd School of Music with Alan Barnhill as my teacher. So, and then from there, I won the Portland Opera principal trombone job. And then
congratulations on that.
Yeah, thanks. That was the very first professional job. That was pretty cool. The person who held that position was actually my undergraduate teacher, Henry. So that was kind of a funny little dovetail action we had there. Mm-hmm. Then I won the principal trombone spot in Spokane Symphony in 2018 and have been here ever since.
All right, very good. So you've been through thick and thin with the orchestra because you arrive and then essentially the next year or so, pandemic strikes.
Yeah.
And yeah, not fun. But coming back now. So tell us a little bit about, from your standpoint, the fantasy.
Yeah, so the fantasy, I mean, I got introduced to it kind of in middle school and high school when I received this solo book that was really thick. It was just a book full of trombone solos from advanced to beginner and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the Creston is definitely at the peak of, I'd say, the advanced side of trombone solos. And I remember seeing it, and it had all these weird clefs in it and stuff that I had no idea what it was all about at the time. And I just remember it sounded interesting, the bit that I could play. And I remember my teacher, he would tell me a little bit about it, but it was always this piece that you just dreamed to play because it just was, it was just had so much to demand of the trombone and of the musician. And it was always one of those ones you'd hear in recording too. And you're like, gosh, I wish I could do that. You know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Christian Lindbergh, to be specific on the recording. He's my favorite soloist. So when I heard him play it, it was kind of donezo. That was the only recording I really listened to. But yeah, the Creston itself, though, I mean, when James approached me with this question of which piece, I mean, that was like a bucket list piece. Mm-hmm. But even at the time when I said I wanted to play it, I still had, there's kind of like a mental mountain to kind of climb a little bit to give yourself confidence to do it. You know, it's you kind of, sometimes you have pieces you're like a little daunted by. And that one, even though it was my favorite and it's a dream to play it, it's still a little daunting. Mm-hmm. But through the year and a couple months I've known about it, I've grown a lot with regards to that. And so it's been a tremendous experience.
All right.
Yeah.
And James, your connection with that piece, is it one that you've been wanting to do, wanted to conduct?
It was one that I knew the title of when John suggested it, because, of course, it is one of the great works of the trombone repertoire. But I must confess, I did not know it. And so when I listened through to it and looked at the score of it, I thought, oh, yeah, that's a really good piece. It's compact, but there's so much in there. It's a fantasy is true, but it really is more of a concerto. I would say it's like a kind of very condensed concerto. You have three very distinct movements, and it's incredibly rhythmic music, mm-hmm. Really fun music. Very hard. I mean, one of the problems, the way he writes, is that ordinarily, you know, when you have a piece of music, you have a key signature which tells you which notes remain sharp and flat throughout the music. He doesn't do that. He just writes in every sharp, flat, natural in front of every note. So you really have to have your wits about you to play this music. But it really does bear the work, because the result is a work that I think is really fantastic, rhythmic and dense, but in a really popular way. And I think I love 20th century music that manages to capture that really difficult thing of being modern but popular.
Right, right. And Creston, has written a lot that's very accessible music, too, and is probably a step less than the fantasy. And has written a lot that's been transcribed for band and played by school ensembles. So he's very much a fine presence in the history of American music.
I did want to add real fast to what James was saying about the key signature and the accidentals and sharps and flats. It's interesting. It really challenged also for me the way I would prepare a piece. You know, you do in a certain way when you're classically trained. You look at the music and you see it a certain way, and it can almost you almost don't really maybe hear in your head what it sounds like because you're just looking at it. You're seeing, okay, a C sharp, then a D, and then like a B flat. Okay, great. Then you're just playing those notes in your head. But you really actually have to step back and try to listen to what the tune or what the melody really is and not focus so much on how it looks, because it looks terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It is really hard to read. It's one of those pieces that, you know, you can pick up some pieces and just kind of maybe sight read a little bit and it could go pretty well. But this one, if you try to sight read it, it would be really hard. It would be near impossible, I think, to sight read it. And I also want to say rhythmically, just doing a little research, I found that he wrote the rhythms out first before writing out the notes. So he like we're saying rhythmically, it's a very rhythmical piece, and lots of these rhythms that are going against each other, three against four, and he writes some really interesting. I don't want to call it like a synthetic accelerando, but he'll write like a quartuplet, then a quintuplet, then a sextuplet, to make it sound like it's, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, you know, that kind of thing, where it's a very interesting technique.
Right.
I know
right.
Other composers, you know, did that too, but I don't know. I like how he did it.
So. Yeah, he really is in love with rhythm, and he's written, if I'm not mistaken, textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
That have to do with that aspect of music.
And he taught in Washington, too.
Right, at
Central Washington.
Central Washington, Central Washington College.
Exactly, at the time, back in the day.
Back in the day. I'm Jim Tevenin. Along with me in studio, James Lowe from the Spokane Symphony and a symphony trombonist, John Church. We are working our way through the fourth Masterworks program. It's going to be up this weekend at the Fox Theater. And it's all about symphonic dancing. We've done West Side Story so far, and the music of Leonard Bernstein, and the wonderful Fantasy for Trombone by Paul Creston. And bringing it to a close is music of who? What? Sergei Rachmaninoff.
Mm-hmm.
So again, his symphonic dances, which has its own story about it.
It does. Well, of course, officially speaking, this is an all-American program, because by the time Rachmaninoff wrote this, he was living in the United States.
He was in the U.S., yeah.
So it was written in 1940, of course, when the Second World War was raging through Europe. Rachmaninoff was in the U.S. in exile because he had grown up in a kind of, I would say, we'd call it probably upper middle class, but in those days, before the Russian Revolution, he was, officially speaking, aristocracy. And then when the revolution came, he and his family really had to leave, so they left Russia behind. And so he's sitting in America writing this work, looking at the Europe that he knew destroying itself, the Russia he knew was gone, the estate that he grew up on and loved, destroyed, essentially. And this is his last major work. This is, in fact, his last symphonic work. And it is this incredibly nostalgic, beautiful, sometimes kind of angry, look back, I think, over his life and over his situation. He said at the time of writing, "I feel like a ghost in a world grown alien." And the music is, I think, some of the best he ever wrote, which is really saying something. Full of amazing melodies, but lamentations and beauty. And in the end, this incredible almost fight between life and death. So he was haunted by this Dies Irae chant through his whole career. Almost every piece he wrote, he hides it somewhere. And in this work, in the last movement, the Dies Irae is the medieval chant for the dead. And in this movement, it comes against some of his own music that he wrote earlier in life, a choral work, the All Night Vigil, where he is talking about the resurrection. So there is this fight between these two very old ideas, almost beyond his lifetime. And I think it is this just stunningly beautiful and impactful work.
It is a wonderful, wonderful piece of music. Three of the the symphonic dances of Sergei Rachmaninoff. It's a wonderful program.
Thank you.
I really am looking forward to hearing it, and it is worth your time to get down to the Fox Theater either Saturday evening at 7:30 or Sunday afternoon at 3 for this program, the fourth Masterworks program by the Spokane Symphony Orchestra. Lots of stuff still coming up in this season.
Plenty still to come, but wait, there's more.
Wait, there's more. So we will encounter those as we move on down the road there. James, thank you, as always, for coming by.
Thanks for having
me. And John Church, thanks for visiting again. I'll have to do this again sometime.
Have me anytime.
Okay, then bring your trombone next time. We can have
I certainly will. Session. Yeah, no problem.
All right. You've been listening to From the Studio here at Spokane Public Radio's SPR Classical. How to go out? Well, how about Sergei Rachmaninoff as composer and as pianist? Here is this little humoresque music of Rachmaninoff, played by the composer.